A judge in New York is considering whether police acted legally when they evicted Occupy Wall Street protesters from Zuccotti Park last night. City officials were at one time considering letting the protesters back without their concealing tents, but supporters got a court order to keep the tents. The judge is now considering that. The Occupy Wall Street website says the movement can't be contained in one square block in Lower Manhattan. It's bigger than that. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is defending his decision to clear and power wash the park.
I've become increasingly concerned, as had the owners of the park, Brookfield Properties, that the occupation was coming to pose a health and fire safety hazard to the protesters and to the surrounding community.
After the clearing, hundreds marched through Lower Manhattan to Foley Square near City Hall, chanting, "This is what democracy looks like." There were similar clearings in Oakland, California, Portland, Oregon, where officials expressed concern about safety and also the effect of the camps on local businesses, some of which have had to lay off staff. Jeff Charlotte is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. His recent story is Inside Occupy Wall Street, how a bunch of anarchists and radicals with nothing but sleeping bags launched a nationwide movement. Jeff joins us now from the NPR studios in New York, and we understand, Jeff, just back from Zuccotti Park. So let's start there. Are people going back in? What's happening? Is there yellow tape? What's the situation?
There's metal barricades and a very, very heavy police presence. And the scene when I left about an hour ago, 45 minutes ago, was quite tense. I saw an officer take down a man for taking pictures, and I tried to get close and said I was pressed and got a very hearty shove. No, I don't think anyone's getting into that park anytime soon. But meanwhile, another contingent of occupiers has moved to another park or another space at Canal and 6th Avenue. That's also in Lower Manhattan. And it's property owned by Trinity Church, which has been very friendly to the movement. So there's a possibility they'll be able to stay there.
Well, in other cities, protesters have also moved to other what they're calling satellite parks. But start with the clearing out, because we'd heard earlier that the police wanted to, as we heard, power clean the area, but also get rid of tents. Now, you know, a body was found in a tent in one Occupy city. A sexual assault allegedly occurred in another tent. The police said they just wanted transparency. They wanted to get rid of the tents. I found it interesting, having just read your article, because you found that those tents were divisive among some of the protesters in New York. Why?
Yeah, I think, and what's interesting, the police decision now is because I think at this point, Occupy Wall Street had reached the conclusion that the small sort of personal private tents, camping tents, could be problematic, and for all sorts of reasons. In some ways, as an assertion of private property and what's supposed to be a big, you know, broad movement, people
sure,
sort of duck away.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the better the tent, you know, the fancier tent, suddenly you have a sort of a class system of tents.
Well, and I think what was interesting with this decision now, which makes, I have to say, I mean, watching the Bloomberg press conference, that was. It was pretty stunningly disingenuous. They had already moved to that by replacing these with big army tents. These are much safer for the winter. And the other important thing about them is that they hold, you know, 18, 20 people. So you're not sort of there's always people on the ground. And what I think hasn't been reported widely enough, and I think I did try and get it in this story, is there is a security system within the park that's been pretty effective. Certainly as effective as a small town police force. And some people might find that, certainly some anarchists might find that problematic as well. Mm-hmm. But to say that it's lawless is to misrepresent the situation there.
Well, but that is the position of the police in other cities as well, that they feel that they can't see what's going on when there are tents, just to speak their side of this issue, that there, you know, drugs were moving in, drug pushers were moving in, and there was activity, they say, happening in the tents. But as you said, you also, I thought it was fascinating, heard these discussions among people. Should we move from the very sort of egalitarian, everybody sleep on the ground, to what in effect starts to be real estate, you know, when tents get set up? So there was that conversation, but as you said, they'd move to these bigger tents. But you mentioned the winter coming on. You write about the founder of Adbusters. This is the Canadian magazine where sort of the first peeps and tweets of this movement began. We're going to talk more about Adbusters, very anti-consumer magazine. But the editor, Callie Lassen, and other editors at Adbusters had said, even before, you know, the last couple of days, that it was time for the Occupy movement to declare victory and scale back the camps before the harsh winter sets in. What did you hear on the ground about that?
You know, it's what I heard on the ground. It's also what I heard from Collie Lawson, who would be the first to say, you know, we played a very small role in the beginning, you know, putting out some tweets and so on. Kali Larson could not be there for personal family reasons. The Adbusters people haven't been on the ground. You know, when you go back and look at what they originally imagined, it was actually kind of small. They said perhaps we could have as a demand that we would ask Obama to form appoint a special committee to look at money and politics. That's a very modest demand. It grew so much larger than them, and I think they would be first to say they have no more say in this than anybody else. But let me go back to something else you said, Rob, and you said to give the police side of the story. I have to ask why you as a journalist feel that that's your job to represent that side of the story when I'm coming from a place when the police are shoving press back. Last night, Penning Press, media blackout. Certainly we want to go to the police and ask their side of the story. That becomes difficult, as it was this morning when I tried to ask an officer for their side of the story. And
I hear you. I just, when you said that you thought it was disingenuous that they just want to take down the tents for whatever the reason, they are saying, I just felt that, you know, that thought that they have expressed should have been expressed, that they felt there should be transparency. That's all. But I do want to hear from you, Jeff, having just come from there. I meant more, yes, you make it very clear that there are no leaders, and Kali Larson would be the first to say he's not a leader. But just that idea, we have about a minute before the break, just that idea of, you know, the suggestion from him and others that, hey, look, you guys have had already such a victory. Why not wrap up before the winter? What was the response to that thought?
I think there's a lot of people who like that idea. And I think that's certainly, I mean, there's any number of sort of proposals out there floating. One of, you know, hunker down for the winter. One, call it victory and come back in the spring. And one, maybe move inside like Madison. Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
We're taking a look at the Occupy movement, even as it is moving. As you know, overnight, police in several cities cleared out the Occupy encampments. We're hearing that in Portland, Oregon, there's nothing but a maintenance crew left where the encampment was. But the protesters have moved to another site. We're talking to Jeff Charlotte of the Rolling Stone, who spent several days there. He's written a terrific article. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. We'd scheduled to talk to you today, Jeff, anyway. And now, of course, we're having the events overnight. And I just want to ask you, because you said something interesting before the break. So it sounded as if I got this right, it sounded as if protesters in New York were talking about maybe regrouping somewhere else anyway for the winter in a building or something. Was that, did that get more, formed?
I think that's certainly been one of the ideas that I think some people are in favor of. And you know, here's where you get the sort of interesting clash for traditional media like us trying to cover this movement that it's not quite leaderless, but it certainly is many, many voices. And so, yeah, some of those voices, I think, are inspired by, you know, the events in Madison, Wisconsin, the anti-Scott Walker protests, which, you know, talk about the sort of the original occupation on a vaster scale. Are thinking about that. Of course, the situation in New York is not the same as it was in Madison, and whether that's possible, I don't know. And there's just as many people, if not more, talking about getting these you know, winter tents, these army winter tents, and these sub-zero sleeping bags, and holding their ground.
Well, and you take us to a fascinating look at how some of these decisions are made. Just tell us one story that I found fascinating. A young woman who, it's in her genes, you know, sort of protest and, freedom of speech is in her genes. Her grandfather was one of the founders of SDS. And so she comes with a lot of experience of being in movements, but she runs up against, you know, the fact that this is not your grandfather's movement. She, was looking to make some demands, and then there were decisions as to whether or not there should even be demands. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, young woman, Cicely McMillan, who was with something called the Demands Working Group, and the working group is sort of a unit of organizing there, and there was some debate over whether or not she even had legitimacy. And she was a very earnest person. She's really dedicated to this. But what I found in talking to her about her effort to organize the whole thing around a single demand, and their proposal was jobs for all, 25 million government jobs at union wages, was a sort of a failure to sort of recognize that certainly the majority sentiment within Zuccotti Park was that by being there, they were an implicit demand. There's the implicit demand of freedom of assembly, of a freedom of speech. But more than that, they have the kitchen, the library, all these things, the medical tent, free health care, free food, that you can build these things together. And so she would clash with a lot of those people in Zuccotti Park. And it was really a very vivid illustration, I think, of a clash between a kind of not even old left, but old new left way of doing things, and this movement, which they many of those kind of more older experienced people find confounding.
Well, and she's only 23. And so you're saying she's automatically – she's already the old way of doing things because what? Because those
Well,
pushing
she's aligned
back...
herself with the Democratic Socialists of America, yeah. which is sort of a long-time group that,
right.
you know, sort of during the Reagan years and, you know, the sort of long years in which there wasn't a very active left in America, they were really, you know – there's a sense, I think, among some of those people, but we've been doing this for decades and you know – to which you can respond as well, you've been failing for decades. You've been failing to organize anything for decades. So I'm not sure if you do know how to do things. But certainly they do bring experience to the table. And, you know, it's sort of experience versus energy.
And what was the pushback on the idea of having a slogan or a demand? What you know, was it just our presence is the demand? You know, what was the pushback on saying jobs for everyone?
I think we are our demands is actually a slogan they came up with. And I think the idea that implicit in the presence are any number of demands. And I mean, given the fact that freedom of assembly has proven to be so controversial, not just today in New York and Oakland and Portland, but in Nashville, where the Tennessee state legislature tried to change the laws to prevent this, where in, down in Florida, where the Broward County Commission decided that you needed 3 days advance notice to speak in public. Freedom of assembly and freedom of speech that is so contentious that even you move beyond that. But I think there's also the idea that I think many people feel that if you have a demand, you get co-opted probably into the Democratic Party. You get sort of a small potatoes response, and you avoid the larger critique here, which is that this is not about tinkering reform. This is about a critique of really very much the way things are in a broad sense. And that's fuzzy, but we have to look at it and say they've been much more successful with that than any traditional group with their demands has been in 40 years.
Well, Jeff Charlotte, you've been with us before to talk about other social movements, religious fundamentalist groups. This is not the conversation we planned to have today. We were going to go deeper into a lot of the people you met, but we have the events of overnight. So I just, in the time we have a couple minutes here, what do you think happens now? You mentioned the kitchen, the alternative banking, the lending library, this village that had been created, which is now taken down. You know, you met beautifully coiffed older women who were coming from very wealthy neighborhoods, saying they could help teachers who would come during the day and or teach during the day and sleep there at night. Where do you think this energy goes?
I don't think it dissipates. It's hard to know. I mean, I've been saying for a long time, anyone who tells you what's going to happen next with this movement is a liar or a fool. I can tell you what I saw today. One of the things that most troubled me was they took the 5,000 Occupy Wall Street library, not just political books, novels, poetry, fiction, kids' books, and they threw it in dumpsters. They threw it in the trash. Now, the city says they've got all these things and they're going to return them, but you take 5,000 books on a damp night and throw it in dumpsters. That's not good news. And I know I when I went down there, I threw some books in my backpack, a book of poems by Donald Hall, to bring down there. And I saw other people doing that to reconstitute the library. And I think that's going to happen across the board.
Jeff, we're going to leave with that image in our minds. Jeff Charlotte, again, his article in Rolling Stone, Inside Occupy Wall Street. We'll link it here now.org. His latest book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Jeff, thanks on a day where, as you said, you just went down to do some reporting at the former Occupy Wall Street site and got pushed around quite a bit. Thanks for rushing back to talk to us about it. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.